I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to the London Review Bookshop podcast. To find out about our upcoming events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
Thanks. I'm really thrilled to be here because I love this book. I think it's a really amazing piece of writing. It's really uncanny, unsettling, beautifully, beautifully written. And I think it also has important things to tell us. So I'm just going to give you a few little thoughts that I have about the book, and then Sophie's going to read a bit, and then we'll do some questions and answers, and then we'll get you involved. So The Water Cure is about three daughters who live in what seems to be a sort of island, a kind of hermetically sealed place bordered by water, with their father king and their mother. And the daughters have to be very assiduously guarded against the toxicity of the world outside. Quite what that world is, we don't quite know for much of the book. And the way they're guarded against that toxicity is through elaborate rituals that are performed on them and with them, fainting rituals, breathing rituals, falling rituals, and the drowning game. And it's a book that I think is about many things. It's about cruelty. It's about violence. It's about the power of fathers. It's about the tyranny of the family. It's about masculinity. And to that extent, I think it's a book that feels weirdly, uncannily of the moment. But it's not just a book of the moment, I think. It's also a book that has a kind of real base and a real depth and a real kind of verticality, and it's kind of in conversation, I think, with all sorts of histories of writing and of ideas, and I think it's going to be big, and I'm very excited about that. And it's written in the most beautiful, assured, deft, controlled prose. So let's hear some of Sophie.
So I'm going to read a bit from the first part, which is narrated, the middle part, which is narrated by the middle sister, Leah. And this is a scene, just after the men have arrived to the island. After dinner, we go about the ritual stealthily. Mother distracts the men with playing cards, fanning them out on the dining table and encouraging them to play. We leave the room through the tall glass doors and watch the shadows of them moving against the wall, arms reaching, the unfamiliar hum of their voices falling away. We pick our way down to the shore with salt cupped between our palms, and we lay it down with the usual care. It is just before I go to sleep, the sky is still light, when I see a strange bird pass overhead. It is not one I've ever seen before, and I look up in awe at the stiff wings, its shadow's shape dark against the sky. It's far away, yet I can hear the drone of its song very faintly through the open sliver of my bathroom window. Grace is in her room, and I call for her. I run to her door and knock on it until she follows me. She stands on the toilet seat to get a better angle, but she only catches the last seconds before we can no longer see it. I wonder where it nests, whether it flies endlessly or bobs on the waves, pulling together a raft made of the faltering world's debris. Grace finds my hand with hers, and we link fingers tightly for a second before she pulls away, as if remembering that we no longer do that. We have never been permitted to cry because it makes our energy suffocating. Crying lays you low, vulnerable, racks your body. If water is the cure for what ails us, the water that comes from our own faces and hearts is the wrong sort. It has absorbed our pain and is dangerous to let loose. Pathological despair was King's way of describing an emergency that needed cloth, confinement, our heads held underwater. What constituted an emergency was me and my sisters crying in unison, unable to stop. I love to cry, though. With King gone, I have forgotten to feel guilty about doing it. There is no one left to notice what I do now. Alone in my room, the windows flung open and the sun lazy against my eyes. Or underwater in the pool, where all water is the same water. Sometimes I imagine the death of my sisters, the image of them standing against the rails on the terrace and paper crumpling down to the ground, one by one, and then the tears come even when I remind myself that they are still alive. It's important, the knowledge that things could always be worse. Imagining them gone makes the edges of my love sharper. In those moments, I almost understand what they mean to me. The night the men come, I cry quite a lot without knowing why. My sleep is shallow. Their distant bodies are thumbprints of heat somewhere lost in the house. Thank you.
Thanks, Sophie. So I think that one of the things that is getting said about your book, for good reason, is that it sits in a tradition of sort of feminist dystopian fiction. But I'm curious to hear from you how you describe the book and also what the genesis of the book was, what the wellspring was for you.
Sure. I would say it's sort of dystopian, but sort of speculative, but also more of a feminist fable, I think, because I think it is in the future, but it also could be kind of any time, if that makes sense. And I know when writing it, originally, for me, it started off a lot more science fiction-y. It was very much more actually like eco-disaster. So I was thinking more about there's a family and they're in an oil rig and the world is flooded and they're kind of dealing with that disaster and then some people kind of turn up and that was sort of the original story of The Water Cure. And as I wrote it, I realised that the thing that was actually interesting for me was not the situation, not the oil rig, not the flooded world. I was just interested more in the dynamics of the family. I was interested more in the kind of gender dynamics by like the people who turned up when they'd never seen men before. And all those things got me thinking, like, what if there was a different sort of disaster, a disaster that was, you know, like a disaster that might be already happening or could be kind of an extension of things that are already happening in the world. And that's sort of where I went from then. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I find that interesting, I suppose, because, so you mentioned a kind of eco-disaster, and I feel like in the book as it is now, there's a kind of echo of that sense of environmental disaster in some way because of the issue of this toxic world that the girls are being constantly protected against and all these measures that they're taking to sort of make sure that they don't get weakened and physically compromised. But it seems that sort of echo of environmentalism is kind of shades into what I think is a really interesting ambiguity in the book. And it sort of gets resolved, and I won't give any plot spoilers, but for me, one of the really interesting things is the question of whether this outside world that the girls are learning about from King, the father, who at the opening of the novel is has disappeared, presumed dead, whether the things that the girls have learnt about the outside world and the dangers to them, so the dangers that are just there in the air, but they're also the dangers of men, mm-hmm. are actually real, or whether this is something of a kind of, a fantasy elaborated by a controlling father in order to sort of protect the women and keep them close in what turns out to be a kind of quite violent way. So I'm sort of interested in how that ambiguity works in the book and how you managed it in the writing, mm-hmm. without giving too much away. Difficult.
No spoilers. the ambiguity was like important for me. I think it was easy for me to kind of write about the idea of it as a disease and kind of a thing that would affect you really physically, because I think like it's really not a stretch. You can kind of, I don't know, all you have to do is like check the internet or like read a news story or just like look at your phone and look at Twitter and there's like something retweeted into your timeline, like just something that's happening in the world, and you can feel like so anxious and so kind of sick. Like you hear a friend tell you something, you hear something in passing, and you can just, it can ruin your day. Like you can feel really ill, or like just you can feel horrible. Like that physical reaction is very real, and it's something we kind of, you know, something that happens to a lot of people every day. But also, I didn't want to explain too much. I wanted to think of it like, you know, the control that King has over the family is very real, and I wanted to like I wanted to keep the ambiguity. I wanted to know, is there actually this thing happening? I didn't want to explain it too much. Mm-hmm. I wanted us to know as much as the girls know. I wanted there to be that kind of, that space where we don't realise.
Mm-hmm. And the fact that the father is called King, I think, is really striking. And for me, when I was reading this book, I couldn't stop thinking about King Lear and about a father who demands kind of absolute loyalty and absolute expressions of love, which is a form of madness. And I felt like there were so many interesting kind of pulsations and reverberations with various texts. I mean, King Lear is one, Prospero in The Tempest is another that kind of jumped out at me, especially there's a scene where King is literally kind of conducting the girls in a screaming ritual. So they're doing kind of orchestrated screaming in order to kind of channel feelings in a sort of safe way. And he's conducting with a baton. And I mean, that to me was so kind of, you know, the Prospero figure kind of puppeteering his figures on his sort of playthings on an island. And there were just so many other texts that kind of felt like they were kind of swimming out of the waters towards me as I read it. And I wonder if you can say a bit about the things that may have consciously or now retrospectively struck you as having informed the book.
Sure. I definitely think King Lear and, yeah, I mean, I King Lear was a thing I read at school, and I think, and other books that kind of really informed it for me. Shirley Jackson, We Have Always Lived in the Castle, I think that's kind of like, that's one that people have like picked up on a lot. The Virgin Suicides, again, is one that people have picked up on a lot. Like, I really loved the idea of that kind of chorus narrator, except in the book, it's the chorus telling the story instead of a chorus kind of observing the girls. And that was really important for me, the idea always that the girls have their own voice. They're not just like, they're not observed. It's them who tells the story, and the men don't actually get a voice, and that is on purpose. And I have seen people say sometimes, like, oh, I'd really like to hear from the perspective of the men. I'm like, well, no. not here, sorry. I would say, Angela Carter has been really important for me in the kind of the story, like the magic toy shop, I think, because just, It's the everyday, but it is uncanny, and I think there's a lot of that in the novel. There's a lot of like tinned food and like things falling apart and everyday boring things, but they all have this cast of weirdness, and that's kind of what I really wanted to do. But I just want to have a bit of everything in it. I felt like there was a lot of influences at play, and maybe because it was my first novel, I was kind of shoving everything in. I was like, let's have some Welsh mythology, let's have some like Shakespeare.
Tell us about the Welsh mythology, of which I know absolutely nothing. How does that come in?
There's a thing in Wales called the Mabinogion, which is basically a collection of traditional Welsh stories. And I went to Welsh school. I was educated in Welsh. I chat Welsh with like loads of my friends and with my family, and at school, which I hated at the time, but now I kind of appreciate a bit more, is that we did have to do a lot of study of kind of Welsh myths and stuff. And at the time I was like, this is like lame, I hate it. But now I'm like, this is great, because actually Welsh mythology has a lot of like strong female princesses and lots of cool rituals and stuff. Like there's one story I particularly like, and in it like someone has to perform a quest, and in the quest they have three sort of bizarre rituals. things like that, I think, fed into the novel a lot. There's a lot in kind of beyond Welsh mythology and more kind of fairy stories. Welsh, like, kind of fairy stories are really important to Welsh culture, I think, and I guess similarly to kind of Irish literature and folklore. And there's a really, really good book called The Welsh Fairy Book, which I absolutely, like, I read it when I was really small. I don't know why, I think it was just in my house. And so many of the stories are just so magical, as you would expect. There's lots about drowned cities, changelings, like people going to dance on the fields with the fairies, and then they come back, like, and 100 years have passed and everyone they know has gone, and yeah, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, that's interesting to hear, because I suppose, I mean, I think reading it, one can really feel the sort of the life and rhythm of all those kind of stories and influences in it, but the mark of how good it is as a book is that it lifts up out of those and is its own thing completely,
because I speak Welsh as well, and because I was educated in Welsh, I think maybe even unconsciously, because I didn't go into it thinking, oh, I'm doing like a Welsh rhythm and stuff. I think you get an ear for how things sound, especially when you've been like forced to memorize great amounts of Welsh poetry for your exams.
Yeah, because the book has quite a sort of incantatory feel to it, I think, that the rhythm of the sentences is really important. And I feel like there's a real interplay between, I suppose, a kind of lyricism and then this sort of incredibly piercing, sort of spare, merciless simplicity of the writing that actually I think is pretty much, you know, one of the most powerful things about it. So it makes sense that that kind of literature is there in the background. Oh, I have so many things I want to ask you. Let's talk a little bit about the three voices. So in the book we have narration by the three sisters, Leah, Grace and Skye, and some of the time it's the three of them narrating together, and some of the time it's and then it's one or the other. Can you tell us a bit about the rationale for that, and also about pulling that off, because it's a difficult thing to pull off, I think, that sort of multiple narration.
So it did start off just as Leah narrating it, and I don't know, like, as I was writing it, I think, oh, this sounds like a bit, I kind of hate it when writers do this, I'm like, oh my god, like the character took over, but I think, like, as I was writing it, I felt a bit more like I wanted to hear from the other characters. I felt like Leah wasn't giving us the whole story. I felt like, because the story was so focused on the three of them and not specifically one of them. Well, I guess that Leah is, she does have a bit more of a role in the book, but it was about all of them, and how they feel about each other, how they have reacted to the men, how they react to each other. It didn't feel fair to give one voice precedent, and I just thought it would be really interesting to look at, like, the events happening but in a different perspective, because even though they are related and they are sisters and they're super close, they're very different. They are very different, and actually differentiating them was difficult, because when you are writing three characters that are so close, it's so easy for them to sound really similar, and that's something I struggled with a lot, especially because they are three girls, they have been raised in this place with no one else, they have so many things in common. The only thing that's different is, like, their age. And how do you differentiate when they don't have markers? Like, you know, like, what music do you like? What television shows do you like? They don't have any of that. So that was a challenge. One of the ways I came around that was, like, using different fonts. So I, like, write Leah in one font, write Grace in another. And it does, like, it sounds stupid, but it does make a difference.
And I think what's really nicely done is that, I mean, you're right that there's an aspect to it which is, they're not that differentiable, partly because they are this kind of weirdly kind of fused unit of the family. And part of what I found so interesting about the book is it is a kind of, a sort of horrible, pared-down nuclear family. I mean, not quite nuclear family, but in its logic, in the kind of relationships between the parents and the children, and specifically the father and the children, the kind of the cult of the family, I think, is so well-rendered. And in that slight homogeneity makes a kind of sense. But then I think what you do really nicely is, through the different voices, you show all the kind of triangulation of desire and envy and hope and disappointment that happens within families through, you know, relationships between one another. So the contamination thread throughout the book I found really fascinating. This idea of the kind of external world as toxic and the men as toxic. And again, this question of, are they really toxic? What does happen to the girls when the men arrive? So there's a kind of midway point where men arrive on the island. I was so interested in... there's a thread in the book which is the voices of women who previously have come to the house. So we learn that previously women would come from the outside world to the house to be cured of the effects of this terrible toxic world. And we get glimpses of this. So we're always quite hermetically sealed in the girls' world, but we get glimpses of the outside world through sort of snippets of things that these women have said when they have come to the house. And there was one that really struck me, which is one of the women who would talk about bringing men, talk about a friend of hers bringing men back to her room, whether due to recklessness or inoculation or both. And I thought, in a way, that was kind of like, for me, the core of the book in a way, because it raised the question of, on the one hand, the sort of, the fact that we're social creatures and we're vulnerable to the other, and that is just part of human life. On the other hand, that vulnerability and that sort of porousness is what makes perhaps women especially vulnerable given the violence of men. But I thought the book did such a beautiful job of, on the one hand, showing us the risks of that sort of incursion of male bodies, and also the power of sort of immunization that contact with toxicity can give you. And again, without giving too much away, that I felt like there was a really beautiful arc to the book, which, I mean, it starts, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, the first section is father, the second one is men, mm-hmm. and the third one is sisters. And the kind of narrative arc is about the kind of sisters coming together and sort of moving away from the power of the fathers and of men. And so I felt like there was this beautiful tension between the kind of risks of toxic masculinity, not to put too fine a point on it, and also the fact that knowledge about that toxicity is what can kind of inoculate women, and it's what gives them the rage and the tools to then go and, you know, whatever. I will leave that up to you. Depends if you've been reading Valerie Solanas, which I have. But that's not really a question, but I just was curious about that as a thread, like. And also perhaps thinking about the genesis of the book and the how you moved from the oil rig idea to this more kind of hermetic idea.
I think, I don't know, if you're a woman, like, even if you haven't kind of experienced overt violence, it's kind of in your everyday, like, it's in like someone who says something to you, or it's in being treated slightly differently at work, or it's even in, like, if you go on a date with someone and you have to text your friends, like, hey, I'm here, like, hope I don't die, lol, and it's lol, but it's like, it's also not lol, it's like, you know, like, I could be killed, I'm like taking a kind of, I'm trusting someone. There's all those small things which I think kind of build up and almost, yeah, form like a sort of layer, and men don't always necessarily understand that. And I was thinking about, like, recently I went to Hampstead Heath with my boyfriend and his best friend, and they're both, like, quite, like, tall, imposing men, and I had a really good time, like, sunbathing, and I had, like, a skimpy bikini on, and I was, like, living my dream. And for both, I said to both of them, I was like, I feel really confident doing this because you're sitting there and, like, no one's going to come along and kind of, like, catcall me or, like, try to talk to me or annoy me. And they were like, oh, that's really sad. And I was like, it's just that... I didn't even strike me as sad. It just, like, that was a thing that you always have to be putting these protections on yourself. You don't go.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Go down like that alleyway, you don't take that shortcut, you don't go in the park at night. All these things you don't even like, you don't realize that you're not doing them. These are protections you kind of put upon yourself. So I think, yeah, that's me. I was like, what if you, yeah, these are ways that women protect themselves every day. These are the small things you don't even think about. And then there are obviously larger ways kind of to protect yourself. Like you can try and be one with like macho culture or something. You can, I don't know. Yeah, that's kind of where the genesis of it came from. And that's kind of, yeah, what I was thinking.
Yeah, and I think what's so interesting is the way, I'm just trying to find a quote. So on the one hand, the book is about what happens when the world is dangerous for women and the measures that women and people who love women have to take to protect them from them. But it's also about what harms get done in the name of protection. Mm-hmm. Because obviously there's this question throughout the whole book of, first of all, do the women need this kind of protection, actually, this amount of insulating, suffocating protection? And also the measures by which they are supposedly being protected are cruel. They're punitive and cruel and abusive. And I mean, I think the timing of when your book happened to come out is so interesting because of all the conversations that are going on about Me Too and consent and violence and the Weinsteins of the world. And also, more recently, the kind of amazing flood of terrible testimonies by women in Ireland in relation to the abortion referendum and the sense of just, you know, I mean, in one sense, this book is a sort of, yeah, a parable of kind of ritualized horror that's inflicted on women's bodies. In other ways, it's just fact. I mean, and I thought there was this amazing quote, this passage, which is, so it's the three girls narrating, and they ask, so they're looking back and talking about King, the father. What are the men beyond the border like? We asked him. Eventually, he gave us an answer. He spoke of perverse appetites. He spoke of bodies grown strong despite the toxic air. Men like trees grown against the wind, knotted, warped. Some thrived on the poison. It was like their bodies had learned not just to overcome, but to need it. He spoke of danger. Men like that tracked around the toxins carelessly. You could feel the effect in their breath, the touch of their hands. Men like that would break your arm without thinking. Like this, he had said, demonstrating on us, clasping both fists around each of our forearms in turn and making as if to snap. We felt the bone threaten to give, stayed calm, and worse. And I thought that was such a kind of terrible and beautiful rendering of the sort of, I think, the kind of sadistic pleasure that not just men, but that we kind of as a culture can take in protecting women and how that those forms of protection can be just as kind of horrible and sadistic. And it made me think about, I think, the tightrope that you're walking in this book, which is how we write or talk or think about violence done to women without re-performing the kind of sadism that is done to them. And I feel like, you know, in the wake of Me Too and all of that, some of the, you know, really necessary and good conversations that are coming out and all the testimonies also really walk that line, because the temptation, I think, of the kind of mechanics of the culture as a whole is to repeat the sort of titillation and the voyeurism and the pleasure that people take in brutalizing women. So, and I think it's a dilemma, but it's one that you deal with beautifully, but it's a dilemma nonetheless. And I wondered if you felt aware of that as you were writing.
Definitely. I didn't want to be gratuitous. I didn't want to glamorize anything. I didn't want to, I don't know, that, like, I think with The Handmaid's Tale season 2, for example, there's a lot of stuff that's been kind of leveled at it about it being gratuitous. I think you could, like, maybe with things like the stories coming out from the referendum and with violence happening in like film and in TV and books against women, like it is really difficult to find the balance. But at the same time, things are happening to women. Like these things have historically happened and do continue to happen. And so it's not as simple as kind of just being like, oh, well, you know, I'm going to find like a sort of fluffy way to walk around it. I think that's a thing that's been leveled at dystopian fiction in general, kind of feminist dystopian fiction, is that kind of the accusation that it does just basically devolve into torture porn, and we just, it ends up kind of writing about the abuse of women in a way that is like titillating. And yeah, I think it is a difficult one to cross, but I also think you can't sugarcoat it, and you can't like not write about it. And also, like as a woman, I don't feel like it's up to us like to find the solutions. I don't think it's enough to say, oh, you're writing dystopian feminism, why don't you just write this amazing, like optimistic view of the world? Why don't you find like a fix? And it's like, well, it's not my job to find a fix. It's not like our job as writers to find a fix for that. We are reflecting what we know and what we feel and what we have seen. And yeah, like if that is horrible, sometimes it is horrible. But it was important for me not to be gratuitous at all, as far as I was able. Mm.
Where are we for time? Should we? Where's Claire?
Where are you?
Yeah. I've forgotten what I was going to ask next. Oh yes. Well, maybe you could tell us a bit about what you're working on now, if you're happy to. I don't mean to push you to.
I was working on like a few things. I don't know. I think these kind of themes will be ones that I always want to return to. Things about women's bodies and how we feel about our bodies, violence into women, but also like the violence we do to ourselves and how to like be, oh my god, how to be a woman. That sounds like just ridiculous, but just how to navigate having a body, how to navigate the world. I think those are the things that interest me because the things that I do. So maybe I'm a narcissist in that sense. But yeah, I also really love short fiction. I'd like to do some more of that and so. But yeah.
Would you read a little bit more for us?
Yeah, of course. So I'm going to read a bit from, we had Leah earlier, so I'm going to read a bit of Grace. She's narrating the last part, and the last part is addressing their father King. In the distant past, I spoke to the damaged women when I could. I was young. They were reluctant to give me details, instead pressing my palms with secret, useless trinkets. Textured soaps, shells on pieces of twine. I hated those offerings even more than the samplers we stitched with swollen fingers. Everything was so heavy with intention and none of it worked. What I needed from the women was information. I knew even then that it was important to arm myself. Know your enemy. When you and Mother occasionally told us things about the world, it had to be done under controlled conditions with time for recovery. It wasn't enough. The more I learned, the more I realized that even being physically removed from it wouldn't save us. The violence came for all women, border or no border. It was already in our blood, in our collective memory. And one day, the men would come for us too. That was the source of the anger. Stronger in the damaged woman, but it was also there in us. The potentiality. I still scream in my sleep. So does Leah, though I have never told her. It's not like cruelty has not been wrought against us. With every new discovery, I found myself looking at you with new eyes. You who had renounced the world. You who claim to put your love of woman above all things. Possibly you were hurting me already in the name of love. I was not sure at that time how it would manifest in me. It didn't take long to find out. Pains in my abdomen, the metallic taste in my mouth. I had always slept on my front like a child, but my chest became too painful. I thought I was dying for some time.
assume. Do you ever think about how and whether it would work as a film? Because it's very filmic to me.
Yeah, definitely. I think quite visually, so I had a lot of thoughts in my mind when I was writing, a lot of images. I had a Spotify playlist, which was like, maybe the trailer for the film, who has ever made, that I would kind of listen to. I have a lot of memories of just like being on the tube to work, and it was like really crowded, and just listening to this like kind of song, these songs on my iPad, and just, not my iPad, my phone, and just trying to kind of like picture new things to happen, and they would always be like images. And I think that's why a lot in the film is quite visual. Like, oh, long white, yeah, in the book, sorry. I was like, oh, long white dresses, and you know, like lounging around, and films of sweat, and yeah.
But it also, I mean, it made me think of two films in particular when I was reading it. One of which was Lanthimos's Dogtooth, which has a similar kind of, you know, strange, familial, cultish regime that you never quite understand the rationale for, and is really unsettling and disturbing. And then the other is Lars von Trier's Melancholia, because that sense of a place that is so kind of like dripping with the disturbing feelings that can emerge between people in relationship to one another. Were those conscious I suppose the Lanthimos film was quite recent. It was probably.
I really love Dogtooth. I think it was definitely like, for me, I think I saw Dogtooth and thought, I want to write a film that makes me feel the way Dogtooth makes me feel. I think I want, a lot of the time I feel that with like a song or, I don't know, like, yeah, a film or a piece of art or something. You kind of want something, you want to make something that makes it feel, you want to echo it almost. Well, not echo it, but just, it kind of, it makes you feel a certain way, and you really want to sort of chase that feeling. And I think it was just so weird, like it was so uncanny, and yet also so normal. Like, you just, it was family just doing normal family things, except they were not doing normal family things. But if you just like walked in the room and looked at the screen, you'd probably be like, well, this is like a boring family drama. But if you actually sat down for like more than 5 minutes, then you'd realize what was actually going on. And for Melancholia, I actually haven't seen it, but I've seen the trailer. And is that the one with Kirsten Dunst?
Mm-hmm.
And it's like her wedding?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so I kind of, yeah, that weird vibe of, yeah, things happening that you can't really explain. And
yeah, it's an amazing film.
Yeah.
Can you tell us just a little bit about the process, the writing process for you, like how, sort of physically, how you do it?
So for The Water Cure, it was quite intense because I was still working full time, and at first it was kind of in the evenings. I would come home and kind of like write a little bit, whatever. And then as I kind of got more into it, I kind of wanted to get more down. I felt more absorbed in the story. I felt more sort of, it all got just really intense. And by the end, I was like waking up at like 5 or 5:30. I would write for like a couple of hours. I'd go to work. On my way to work, I'd be listening to that Spotify playlist of my trailer. I'd get into work and I'd have my laptop with me. I would like do my job distractedly for like 4 hours. I'd go to the coffee shop and like write some more, do my job for a bit more, and come home and like write again, and then just go to bed, and then wake up and just do it the next day. Like, I do not recommend it, because it was like really, really hard going, and I think like my social life like definitely suffered. But for about a couple of months, it was sustainable. And it was worth it to me to just be in that weird zone where I was so immersed in the sisters, and I just cared for them so much. It all became so claustrophobic, but I think the book is claustrophobic. Like, I'm not sure I could have written it if I hadn't gone into that weird insular state as much as I had. And I really enjoyed it. Like, looking back, I'm like, it was kind of a horrible time, but also the best time of my life. Mm-hmm. So.
I hear you. Let's have some questions from the audience.
Hey.
I was just wondering, because sometimes I get in a place where I think about, God, if only I lived in a female commune. Do you ever think about what would have happened to the sisters maybe if the men hadn't arrived, at least for a time? Obviously, the mum might have carried on as was, but
yeah, I think I have thought of this personally, and also because Love Island started last night, and it really got me thinking, like, oh my god, what would like an all-female Love Island look like? What would Love Island look like if they rejected the man? I think because King was always there, he kind of like poisoned it, and maybe if King hadn't been there, at the start of the book, he dies, so what would have happened if it was just Mother and the girls? I think you can see, like, at the beginning, because it is just them, it is the four of them for a few months, and they do settle into this, like, kind of, not utopian dream, but they do have this, like, nice rhythm of life, and they think, like, that could have just kind of continued if, like, the people hadn't washed up and ruined everything. I think it might even be already, because I'm not very tired. I'll send it to you.
Hello. I was just really curious, like, listening to you both talk. It's obviously so fascinating, and I've read the book, so I kind of have a sense of it. That it's obviously, because it's about three sisters, that's very much at the forefront, but I was just thinking about the fact that a lot of books have come out recently that are kind of around issues of motherhood or questions about whether to have children or if you have them, what that means, and, you know, obviously Sheila Hetty's book, but not just that, you know, it's very much something that's kind of coming into the forefront of publishing for I'm sure many reasons that I don't fully understand. But I was just wondering, I was so interested about how you explored parenthood, so not just motherhood, but kind of what it means to be a father, what it means to be a mother, and how much, when you were thinking of this as a feminist book, how consciously you were exploring the roles of motherhood and fatherhood and the kind of strictures of those, or how much it just subconsciously came out as a kind of inherent part of thinking about gender. I'm just curious how much that was a driving force, if at all, for you in your considerations.
So I think I wasn't thinking of it like specifically super much. I think like I just don't overthink things too much when I'm writing generally. I think it was interesting to me to write a family that was extreme, like... It could be a normal family, but just taken to the kind of dialed up a few notches until it becomes like not quite right. I was interested in the idea of this father figure who is like, you know, he's protecting his girls, he's the strong man, kind of creating this amazing safe place, and they're all gonna be fine. But at the same time, he's this controlling person who completely is not doing that. He's like harming the people he loves, and the mother is like, she's complicit in that, but she also does love the girls so much. And I just think, like, yeah, mother-daughter relationship is one that is so fraught, and I love my mum with my life, like, she's amazing. Some of you have met her, she's great. But also, like, even when I was a teenager, I remember, like, we didn't always have a good relationship. Like, our relationship was horrible. Like, we could hurt each other in a way that no one else could. Like, she would call me horrible things, I would call her horrible things. Like, there was a lot of weird, specific kind of violence that a mother and daughter can do against each other, and a lot of that is about like becoming a sexual being and shame and all these things which are tied into it. And yeah, so it was interesting for me to explore that a little more in the book.
Hello, it's really interesting hearing about the kind of comps and influences that inspired you when you were writing it. I was wondering whether the Poisonwood Bible was something that you kind of had in mind, or whether that was something maybe that had occurred to other people, they'd mentioned it, because it's that kind of religious zeal on the part of the father and the way that the daughters are just so subject to it. I thought that was a really interesting, I mean, obviously vast differences between them, but yeah.
I have actually not read that, but I should.
Hi, so I haven't read the book, but I really want to. It sounds absolutely up my street. So I teach creative writing, and this year I gave my undergraduate students the New Yorker story Cat Person, which is about a girl who goes on like a bad date, and it like raises all these interesting questions about consent. And I know as a teacher you're supposed to be open to whatever reaction students have, but all of my students were saying, oh, you know, it was her fault. She shouldn't have gotten into that situation. So as a teacher, it was sort of, you know, personally upsetting to hear that. But then it was also hard to get away from this idea that I was trying to teach the students something through fiction. So that's why I thought your comment earlier about how you weren't really trying to teach anything through this book. So I wondered if you had like any more like thoughts on that, sort of how to like avoid that in your fiction of like not trying to like instruct people, but rather like show an experience.
Yeah, I definitely think I am more, when I write, I'm driven a lot more by like my feelings than by theory and stuff. And I think like I could actually like, I always feel a little bit at a loss. I feel like I should have more theory. I should have more like intelligent stuff that I have like researched behind it. And often it is literally like me having a lot of feelings and writing about those feelings in a way that isn't kind of like academically pinned down or rigorous. And yeah, I think that's, I don't know, I think with a book that people are calling feminist, and I do feel like it is a feminist book. Like for me, I'm a feminist. I've written a book about women, centering the experiences. I didn't set out to write a book that was like, I'm writing a feminist tome. Like, was like, not it at all. It is like, again, my feelings. I never want it to be like, I never want people to think like, oh, this is like a manual or this prescribed thing, or this book is like telling us that men are evil and we need to like, I know, kill all men, but we could, but like we can't. that wasn't what I set out to do with it. And I feel like it's a lot of responsibility if people are gonna, you know, like kind of, teaching people with this book that I've just, I don't really know what I'm doing. it's just, yeah. Sorry, does that make sense?
Hello, Sophie. Thank you very much for speaking to us today. It was a fantastic little session. I was wondering, is there one, obviously we sort of hear from two of the sisters much more than the third, but is there one of the characters that you personally identify more with than the others? Obviously they both react very differently to the situation that they're in. And I know I personally, when I was reading it, empathized much more with one of the characters than the other, but I was just wondering if you did, if one of them is you.
It's funny because I started writing it and I was like, I am a total Leo. Oh my God. And then as I continued writing it, I think by the end I felt a lot more hard-nosed and I was like, I'm Grace. I'm tough. I've got this and I'm going to be fine. So I don't know. I don't know if maybe that says more about the character I prefer or about like who I was at the start of writing the book and who I was at the end of it. And maybe I started out as a Leo who's quite like, not helpless, but she kind of very naive and she's naive. She doesn't kind of have the defenses that her sisters have. And by the end of writing the book, I just felt a lot harder in myself and a lot more like I had like learned how to be tough, like Grace. So I think now I would say I feel like I identify with Grace a lot more. Which one do you identify with?
Definitely.
Okay. No one wants to be a Leah. She's like,
what about Skye?
She's great.
She's adorable.
Skye is adorable. Yeah, but
no one identifies with the mother.
Yeah.
Poor mum.
Yeah, but Leah is great as well.
Well, thank you so much for coming. Thank you, Sophie, for writing such an amazing book. I think it really is amazing and I'm very excited about what it's going to do, and it's going to be big, and you were here. And
thank you for talking to me.
You can say you heard her speak like in the early days. And yeah, thank you so much. It's wonderful to talk to you.
Thanks for listening. To find out more about London Review Bookshop events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.